You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us on the first half of the program today is Joe Hyman. Dr. Hyman is the director of the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies, and he's here to talk about something that we've heard a lot about in the news lately, and that's DACA and how it affects our students and some of the things that Joe and his center and other people in the community are doing to help our students. Joe, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Happy to be here.
Now, as I mentioned, you are the director of the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies, and we'll talk a little bit more about the center in a little bit, but as I mentioned, DACA has been in the news a lot over the last few weeks. And you, you know, a good reason, Dr. Natalishu as well, reached out to our students and kind of let them know, hey, you know, we're behind you and we want to let you know that we're here to help. But for the benefit of our listeners, because we've heard a lot of these acronyms thrown around, tell us a little bit about DACA and what that is.
So DACA was a special action to give temporary protection to a subset of people who are unauthorized. About 800,000 people hold DACA status. The word DACA, D-A-C-A, stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And these people came to the United States below the age of 16. Actually, on average, they came at the age of 6.5. So they were children who almost always arrived with family members and were not necessarily the ones who made the decision, actively made the decision themselves to come without authorization. So if they'd been in the country for at least 4 years and they arrived in this childhood period, the Obama administration in 2012 decided to let them apply for something in a very legalistic sense, deferred action. In other words, the government said, okay, we don't think you should be people that we are going to go out of our way and arrest and deport. We are going to put off, we're going to defer our possible action against you. And we're actually going to give you some identification that allows you to do things like cross through checkpoints, like we're trapped inside of checkpoints in this region. You can get this identification that would allow you to travel that way. So they allow people to apply. About 800,000 hold this status. But it was never embodied in a definitive law. This was its great limitation. So when Donald Trump was elected, it was unclear what he would do about the DACA holders, documented youth, as people sometimes say. And sometimes he said that they're great and they're a great asset to society, which they are. And sometimes he said, no, we have to crack down on this. Finally, the Trump administration, under political pressure from the anti-immigrant political movement, decided that they would end the DACA program. This was a few weeks ago. And the way that the program is going to be ended, it's kind of going to be phased in. So this is very important in a practical sense. If any of you out there listening are documented or you have family members or friends who are documented, these dates are very important. First of all, there's no new applications. Second of all, people who already hold the status of DACA are allowed to continue in that status until the date of expiration. And you can know what the date of expiration is because it's on the work authorization card.
And if
the date of expiration is before March 5th, those people are given through October 5th, which is coming up real fast, to apply to renew their DACA status for another 2 years. So if their expiration is sooner than March 5th, they can apply for another 2 years, and their deadline for applying is October 5th. If their expiration is after March 5th, they simply expire out of the system, whatever date is their expiration date.
And of course, this is something that, for obvious reasons, raises a lot of concerns among students. And as you mentioned, many of these students came here when they were children, and they had no say-so as to, you know, my parents are moving, so I have to go with them, or I'm going to stay here. And so we have a lot of Mexican national students and students who, because of DACA, grew up here in the United States and are now enrolled at our universities. What kind of information, what kind of help, workshops are you all doing or have done for our students?
We will continue to be available to provide information. There is a Dreamer group at UTEP, and there's also an advocacy group. Advocacy group is education, not deportation. The Dreamer group, it's called the Borderlands Dreamer Alliance. So we at the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies have contacts. We can refer people to those groups. We will continue to do educational events through this coming year to give people information about not only about renewing the DACA status. We're working within a very short window right now. But also the other emphasis we have is for everybody, DACA or not, to know their rights in the United States. So one of the things that we'll be teaching people is their constitutional rights. Interesting thing about the U.S. Constitution, an important thing that we should all cherish, is that the Constitution says that all persons in the United States have rights under the Bill of Rights. And among those rights are protections against unreasonable search and seizure. And search and seizure includes both your possessions, it includes your car, it includes your dwelling, it includes you yourself. You know, when you're held without actually being arrested, then you are being seized by the police. Now, you have a limited number of things that you have to provide to police for good reasons of public safety. You have to be able to tell them your name. Beyond that, you don't have to tell them anything else. And in the circumstances in which police are empowered to hold people for immigration authorities, to stop people at a lawful stop and hold people for immigration authorities without actually arresting them, it's important that people who might be stopped by the police know their rights. And I think the police would agree that everybody should know their rights. You do have to tell your name. You don't have to say anything else. And you should say, I don't have to say anything else, or I don't want to say something without advice of an attorney. You should at least have an idea about an attorney that you can call. You should not give permission to have your house entered. Don't open the door. Even opening the door a crack to hear somebody is considered to be permission to barge in on the house. So don't open the door. Talk through the closed door, as awkward as that is. Don't give permission to have a car searched. If you're stopped in a car, you do have to provide a driver's license, registration, which in Texas should be a sticker on the window, and insurance, but you otherwise don't give permission to have a car searched. It's terrible to have such a restricted and closed and, you know, frightened, we could call it, life, but Texas, setting aside DACA and its expiration, Texas just passed a piece of legislation, Senate Bill 4, SB 4, which empowers all police, state police, local police in the state of Texas, without deference to their supervisors, to stop anybody they want to in a lawful stop and hold them for immigration authorities. So it's really, really important that everybody out there in a calm, controlled and reasonable way know their rights. So we're going to be doing that the remainder of the year.
And for people who may have questions about that, where are your offices located, Joe?
So we're on Hawthorne, 1514 Hawthorne, just about a block south of the main campus, south of Schuster.
As far as what you were just mentioning, and you know, a lot of people don't realize this, the fact that, you know, some of these young people who have been interviewed, they really don't have any roots in Mexico because they were brought here at a very young age. Some of them don't even speak Spanish that well. And it's scary to think that you're going to be sent to another country.
Right. They're certainly not ready to be removed to another country. Mexico, or we should be clear that there are people from all over the world. I mean, it is El Paso and almost everybody here in this situation is from Mexico. But nationally, there's a lot of people from the Philippines, from China, Korea, Poland, so forth and so on. Yes, they're not ready to go home. These are young people to a greater or lesser degree have been acquired the language and culture and social connections. Mexico is now having a significant problem of youth who have gone home with their families, been deported, or just moved home with their parents, who are entering Mexican schools not speaking Spanish and not being used to the Mexican educational system. So students who come from the United States are behind Mexican students in addition to the language problem they oftentimes have. No, absolutely. So they're not well prepared. On the other hand, you know, one of the positive things about DACA and possibly positive things about the legislation that DACA was an attempt to kind of substitute for failed legislation, but one of the positive things is that it gave a strong set of incentives to youth to continue their education or to get steady employment or to enlist in the military. So DACA required youth above a certain age to be getting an education or finish their education, get a high school degree, get a GED, continue in the university, or have steady work. And the legislation that's been proposed that might come in, again, oftentimes will give people temporary and then in the long run permanent status in the United States based on maintaining these sorts of forms of connection to American society. So it's been very positive. We know that DACA resulted in a significant improvement in employment, people earning much more money. They oftentimes open their first bank account. More than half of them open their first bank account, which is really a sign of their participation in the economy. One of the institutions that benefits from DACA was UTEP, was the university. UTEP has a significant hundreds of students with DACA status, and EPCC even more so. So we're beneficiaries of this. We're significant beneficiaries in the borderlands. So it's a significant part of the population of El Paso, and there are things about this community here that make it more immigrant connected, I would say. One of them is the so many people who are binationals who have status in both countries and go back and forth. So there's this close kind of everyday cultural and linguistic and personal connection between Mexico and the United States that really does help shape this community. People, if they can, stay in this region because they're close to their family in Chihuahua. So it really is a very connected, very transnationally connected community. The people who have had DACA status are just one piece of that whole situation.
Joe, for the benefit of our listeners again, if you wouldn't mind giving us perhaps a website or a phone number for the center where they can go and find additional information about it.
Right. We do have a website for the center. So probably the easiest way to find the website is to look for UTEP CIBS. A phone number, 747-6192. Now, it's important to say, you're welcome to call us and we're happy to talk with you, but we're not lawyers. And we don't even say, but I play one on TV.
On the radio.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I am not going to give you legal advice. And I think this is a moment where somebody who has immigration issues should get legal advice, frankly. And I can tell you a couple of dates like I did at the beginning, but I can't give you specifics about your individual case or those of your loved ones. There are important legal service providers in the community. There is Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center, Las Americas. There is Diocesan Migrant and Refugee Services. There is the Texas Civil Rights Project. There are other ones. Those organizations not only can talk to you to see if you qualify for reduced cost or free legal services, and whether what you're looking for in the law is realistic, which is an important consideration, but also they can give you references to reliable, honest private sector legal providers. Many, many immigration lawyers in this community are really terrific people and hardworking and generous and so forth. But you should try to make sure that you're getting realistic and fair legal advice. Yeah, because people can sell you hopes and take your money, and there's really no realistic chance that something's going to happen. So I don't want to be too negative, but that's the one of the risks out there. There's also a famous problem in the Spanish-speaking community, which is with notarios and notaries. But in the United States, a notary is a very minor thing. It's somebody who just gets a signature and puts on a stamp. But in Latin America, notarios have more legal functions. People see them in the United States and think that they're able to do legal services for you. But really, you need to get to a lawyer or an accredited representative.
Jill, thank you so much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Dr. Joe Hyman. Dr. Hyman is the director of the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies. Again, thank you so much for being with us here today.
You're very welcome.
The Weekend will return right after this. And joining us on the second half of The Weekend right now is John White. John is the garden curator for the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens here on campus across the street from our building, Cotton Memorial. And generally, we would have John on one of the local campus shows, but because there's so much going on and you need to get ready for fall weather, which is going to be here before you know it, John decided to come join us and tell us a little bit about some tips. John, thank you so much for being with us here today.
You're welcome, Louis. Thank you.
Now, as I mentioned, fall is upon us, and of course, some of the stores will want to tell us that it's almost Christmas and everything else. However, our plants know kind of what's going on. And so, as you mentioned before we started the interview, you want to give our listeners some tips on what to do.
I mean, our plants have a built-in ability to kind of feel, the temperature, so to speak, when things are cooling down, days are getting shorter. So they have a natural way of shutting down and getting ready for winter. And we'll start to see that as cool temperatures start to come in, days get shorter. We're going to start to see that. But we still need to keep up with our garden activities like watering. So even though it might be cooling down a little bit to us, trees still transpire water off. Plants are still losing water, so they need to be replenished. And, some of the forecasts for this fall and winter are we're supposed to have a mild winter. So that may mean that we're going to have an extended fall. So plants may shut down slowly and, it'll be, above normal temperatures, so we'll still have to continue watering. So when you water, you want to water deep enough to wet the entire root system. So on a tree, we're talking, 2.5 feet deep. So we're talking about slow watering where the water infiltrates. And the root system is equal, 1.5 to 4 times the height of the tree. So it's not just the drip line, it's beyond the drip line. So if your tree's in a yard area, more than likely you're going to be watering the entire lawn. And the trees will be benefiting some as long as you're putting enough water on. But remember, the grass steals water away from the trees. So you want to water enough that you give the grass some water, but you want the water to go on past the grass roots down to the tree roots.
And what about some other plants? If people have in their courtyard, vinca, papyrus, anything
right.
else like that?
All that same thing needs to be watered to the depth of the root system when you do water. Now, you don't have to do it every day or every other day. You can start to stretch it out as it gets cooler, so you might be watering once a week. But it's important to give that deep watering when you do water. So don't just wet the surface of the soil and call it done.
What about fruit-bearing trees, or if you have a garden, vegetables? Is there something that people need to watch out for?
Well, vegetables and stuff, if there's any diseased fruit that falls or overripened fruit that's fallen off a tree or off of a vegetable plant, you want to make sure you pick it up. Some diseases can actually carry through in the compost pile. If you have a compost pile, and now is a good time to start a compost pile because you're going to start to get a lot of plant material, leaves falling and things like that. Just you have to match it up with something green that'll keep the composting process going. And that can be food scraps from your kitchen. you know, vegetable peeling, stuff like that. No meats, greases, you know, dairy products, things like that. But your leaves are brown material, and you need green nitrogen source in there to keep it going. So that's where your food scraps and stuff help. And you want to keep the food scraps, of course, covered, because otherwise you're going to invite, you know, critters in, and you're going to have skunks or squirrels or whatever, you know, trying to dig in there, or cats or something. So you want to make sure you cover it up. Add a little bit of soil in there, because the soil has millions of bacteria in it. So when you're putting that in your compost pile, you're helping to add bacteria that will help to break things down.
With some of the rains that we had not too long ago, it seems like a lot of yards suddenly saw an abundance of weeds popping up. What are some of the tips that you would give our listeners as far as getting rid of those, what to do, and, you know, do they use Roundup or anything else?
Yeah, some of the weeds that came up from the rains and stuff, most of them have already flowered and either have seed on them or gone to seed, or they're fixing to put seed on. But usually those plants are what we consider fairly mature, and herbicides don't work very good on older plants. And so the best thing to do is probably to pull them. You know, if there's a bunch of them, then you may have to go in with a mower or a string trimmer or something, knock them down. But you want to get them picked up, because if you leave them there, those seeds will, you're going to drop seed all over the place. So you're going to have a worse problem than what you had this year. So you want to make sure you get those things picked up and put them in a trash can, get them out of there. If you, you know, if it's heavy, you know, tough weed like kochia or some of the pigweeds, you know, you can mow them off, but you leave a stump in the ground that's, you know, 3/4 of an inch in diameter. And yeah, you've gotten rid of the top part, but now you got this little stem stalk that's right there at ground level, and you trip over it. And, you know, so if you don't cut it down close enough to the ground, it actually can put out some branches, some shoots, and it'll reshoot out again, so you'll have it
coming
back.
What do those look like, John, those that you just mentioned?
Pigweed is a weed that has kind of an arrow-shaped leaf, so it's got a little bit of a point on it, and grows up fairly rapidly, has kind of a, right now it's developing a little bit of a stickery type stuff on the stem, so if you try and pull it, you'll feel a little bit of stickery type stuff. Earlier, when they were real green, they were easy to pull. And they don't have a very deep root system, so they are fairly easy to pull up. Kochia, on the other hand, has a deep root. It's kind of real, real dark green, almost a bluish green color, and has a little bit of red in it. And as we go into fall, it turns somewhat of a reddish or burgundy color. They're actually real pretty. And there are some ornamental kochias called burning bush that does have the real deep red, you know, burgundy type color to it. That's actually an ornamental plant.
And so some of these have flowers as well, correct?
The flowers on pigweed and kochia are very, very inconspicuous. You cannot see them. But when they go to seed, you'll see the you know, pigweed. One of the names for the pigweed that's real common right now is called careless weed, and it has a little fuzzy stalk. It looks like kind of a velvety, but when you touch it, it's kind of prickly and stuff, and that's just full of thousands of seed. So if you don't get those cut off and put in a bucket or something, you're going to be spreading thousands of seed per plant all over your garden.
I've seen some of them that it looks almost like ground cover, and that just kind of popped up after some of those rains.
And that could be, we have a couple things that come up. One is spurge, or a lot of people call it milkweed. And one way to test it is just to break off a piece of the stem. If there's a white sap that comes out of it, that's spurge. It's a euphorbia. And again, it has a very inconspicuous flower, and it flowers very quick and sets seed very quick. So when you go to pull it, a lot of times you knock the seed off. And so even though you pulled it, it's dropped seed for next year. And so you want to try and get those things controlled, you know, when they're young. So get them hoed out, sprayed, whatever you're going to do, but get rid of them. But they are very fast growing. We have an upright species that grows tall, and then we have one that grows flat on the ground.
You mentioned earlier about critters and pests, and we have seen houseflies, and there are a lot of other like gnats and stuff like that. And some people have mentioned that there are certain plants that you can get to get rid of some of these pests. But at the same time, we have some that just all of a sudden they just popped up, as you mentioned earlier, and we have two problems, that plant and the pest.
Right. A lot of those little gnats and tiny little insects that fly around, they're usually drawn to an area that may be wet or has a lot of organic matter where it stays very moist. And so unless you find those spots and eliminate them, you're going to continue to have a problem. So a lot of the organic controls as far as companion plants and stuff don't necessarily work. The plant almost has to be right near, you know, right next to where the problem is. And but usually it's where a moist, you know, poor drainage or areas in the shade and there's a lot of organic matter, leaves and, you know, stuff like that that's staying real moist. And those gnats and flies like to kind of form in those areas. So, again, if you kind of clean some of those areas up and dry them out, you can get rid of the problem. Now, mosquitoes, of course, are a problem. And any standing water, so kind of, you know, once a week, walk through the garden and make sure that you don't have any areas that are collecting water, pots or tires or, you know, whatever it might be that can collect water, make sure those are dumped out. So if you have a sprinkler system, you know, sometimes it'll collect water in an area and you just need to make sure you dump those out.
What about as far as, you know, you mentioned getting compost, and some people put stuff out to kill some of these weeds, other stuff like that. But that can also be a hazard sometimes to pets.
Right. I mean, there are pre-emergent herbicides that kill weeds from seed. So just as the seed begins to germinate, it'll kill the weed, so you'll never see it really come up. It's killed before, you know, as soon as it comes out of the seed. So that product, you know, has some good intentions, and now is the time it needs to be applied. So between now and, say, the first part of October, maybe the middle of October at the latest, that needs to be put down to stop winter weeds. So we're going to have our winter annuals germinating pretty soon, and that'll be like the mustards that, you know, are a problem during the winter and the early spring. So they germinate right now, so you want to get the pre-emergent put on if you're going to use it. But if you have pets and stuff, yes, you do need to read labels and be real careful. There, unfortunately, there's not a real good organic control for, you know, a lot of the weeds as far as a pre-emergent. And so keeping the grass thick, you know, trying to avoid any bare areas where weed seed can get in there. And then, you know, hopefully that'll help take care of some of the problems. And then if you do have some young weeds coming up, you know, get in there with a little hand hoe or something and just kind of knock those down, because they will become big weeds with lots of seed.
Well, John, unfortunately, just like the season is changing, our clock has ticked off, but we're going to have you back because, you know, people are going to start noticing their grass getting kind of yellowish, and as it gets colder, and they're going to want to plant stuff. And of course, we can't forget our annual Christmas tree picking and all that stuff right. That we need to have you back for.
Okay.
Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Louie. Thank you.
We've been visiting with John White. John is the garden curator for the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens here on campus. Thank you so much for being with us. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Duran Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louie Sines.